I am a hydrogeologist. That means I study groundwater. I came here for the first time in May of 1997 to study the groundwater at the mine site. I've been on volunteer teaching staff a few times and have taught this summer or this fall session of Elder Hostel, Holden Elder Village for a number of years now. Last night, we didn't really cover very much of a technical nature. From my perspective, it was more just me up here arm waving and showing slides and trying to get people to laugh so that they come back again tonight. Tonight, we're going to talk about geology, and we're going to do it in an hour. So, and even as smart as you guys are, there's a lot to learn from all geology in an hour. So, and then tomorrow, Jim and I are going to team teach, cooperatively work together to do a little writing and then go take a geology hike and a writing hike and a community hike and a puzzle solving hike and a beauty seeing hike and we'll find out whatever else is out there for us. And then Thursday and Friday, I'll do a couple of talks on the mine site itself, because I've been involved with that for 13 years now. The proposed plan for how the Forest Service is going to direct the mining company to clean this area up has been published. And so that will move forward and will have major impact on the village. I do have a couple of manuals left. These are high quality. I know I made them myself. It took like 45 minutes. So if you don't, if you weren't, here's one. Okay. All right, absolutely. Putnam's Geology is a very good basic geology book. Everyone should have one on their shelf. Putnam's Geology. Actually, it may be out of print now. This is old school stuff from like the Triassic, I think, because that's when I was doing geology.
Don?
Yes, sir?
Are we going to talk about the Vishnu Schist?
We're going to talk about the Vishnu Schist. That's the stuff that's in the Grand Canyon.
That's my attempt at humor.
Oh. Well. All right. If you want to read a book about geology, you can read John McPhee. At one time, I thought I would try to write a geology book to help explain stuff, and then I read this and thought I can move on to something else because it's already been done. Just incredible. This is a compilation of four books that he published. Just Google up John McPhee and any of his geology books. His ability to just I strive and some days think I'm okay at making geologic concepts fairly common. And he's bloody marvelous at it, and I hate it. The Roadside Geology series, if you're familiar with these are excellent books to my way of thinking. They're neither as they're not too cartoon and they're not too technical. This is another one called Northwest Exposure that covers the whole Northwest. It's written by the same team, so it's also very good. All right. Studying geology, we have one thesis for how we study geology. We have one fundamental concept of geologic forces and how they shape what we can see. We have five principles or laws, and we have three types of rocks. Now, our thesis is geology is an observational science, blah, 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 hypothesis, blah, blah, make assessments of geologic structure or geologic history of an area. Now, I'm going to read that out of your manual here because it's stated a little more clearly than that. Under topic one, fundamentals of geology, thesis. At its essence, geology is an observational science, which means it is based on observation of rocks, landforms, and the relationship in space of rock units to one another. Once observations have been made, it is possible to make interpretations or advance hypotheses about the geologic makeup and history of an area. Geology is an observational science. Physics is an experimental science. Math is a calculation science. But the way to do geology is to go out and really see it. We go out, we see it, we talk together as a community, we overcome the confusion of the geology, we figure things out, we move on down the road, we do it at another place, and at some point in the future, we are able to put the pieces together into a coherent geologic story. So that's that. Of course, I wrote this upstairs a little bit ago, and so I didn't know all the words, which is why that's there. Okay. And I realized while I was upstairs having my shower that my, what do you call it, Jim? Is it your pedagogical technique? The way that I get people is part absurdity, part misdirection, and part bribery, which is why there was beer last night and there's licorice tonight. So, because I don't think giving you guys a bunch of beer before Vespers is a really good idea. Might be fun for me, but anyway. All right. The fundamental concept to always keep in mind about geology is that everything we see is due to the interplay between constructive geologic forces and destructive geologic forces. If there's one sentence that next year, if we're all fortunate, me and Cliff and Gay will be back, I will say, Gay, what was the one important thing I said last year? And she'll say, And if there's one thing, everything that we see, and we can put this to the test tomorrow, and we can put this to the test the rest of the evening tonight, to say, how does that fit into constructive forces, the earth material being brought up from ground or from sea level into an elevation, and then destructive forces. Everything that we see should be attributed to one of those two things and how they interplay. That's the fundamental concept. So we have a thesis, which is it's an observational science. We make hypotheses. We try to figure stuff out. We have a fundamental concept, constructive versus destructive forces. The constructive geologic forces are due to a very few number of ideas. The Earth is hot in the center. It's cold at the outside. Heat dissipates from the center to the outside. Sets up convection cells, which is what moves the plates around on the surface of the Earth. The plates bump into each other. We get earthquakes. We get mountains. We get volcanoes. That's... I just did geology in like 6 minutes. That's kind of a joke. But that, again... It's hot in the middle, it's cold on the outside, convection cells get set up in the mantle and move the plates around. Our best current explanation of that is called plate tectonics theory. Now I have back here a prop, which is very good. Once this gets hot enough, this is an old, can you see this over there? This is, I'll probably get in the way here, so I'm gonna move it over a little bit. This is a lava lamp, and once these blobs start rising, someone will illuminate or let me know about that, and then I can further explain how that's such a good model for the way the Earth operates. Now, last year when I was here, I taught people that the Earth was composed of three things, a crust, a mantle, and a creamy nougat center. I went back home after that and I realized that really wasn't the case, that the Earth doesn't have a creamy nougat center. So, that's kind of a joke. What the Earth really has is a crust, the stuff we're standing on, a mantle. This shows it as this is a three-layer system, the core. The core is dense material, probably largely iron. There's probably nickel in there too. And in reality, there is an inner core and an outer core. The inner core is probably solid, even though it's blazingly hot. There's so much weight on top of it that the molecules can't move around anymore, which is how we define a solid. This, the lava lamp is a little bit of an explanation of how heat works. Hot in the middle. cold at the outside. What will happen is these blobs will raise up to the top. They'll cool as they get to the top, and they'll fall back down. Here we have blobs. In reality, what we think happens in the planet is there are these convection cells that get built up in the mantle that push the plates around on the surface. These next couple of figures are not real important to what we're talking about right now. They're in there for completeness sake that show that there are about, I forget what it is, 15 or 18 or 20 small plates that are riding around on the surface of the Earth on the mantle, which is a very, 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 very viscous liquid. Is glass a solid?
No.
No, glass is a liquid. Glass is an extremely viscous liquid. You go to a church back in England that's from the 1200s, and the bottom of it is thicker than it is. The glass is thicker at the bottom than it is at the top because it's been hanging in gravity for the last 800 years now, and it flows. The mantle does the same thing. Here is a diagram of where we find earthquakes. Strangely enough, it's at all the plate boundaries. This was some of the evidence that was used back in the 60s and 70s to put together the theory of plate tectonics. Here's a picture that shows how the continents fit together. The first person who talked anything about plate tectonics was Alfred Wegener back in about 1917, somewhere around there. He got laughed out of most of the geologic societies. He just happened to be right. So the constructive forces are related to heat being dissipated, pushes up mountains, pushes plates into each other which collide, and they push up mountains. We push material up into the environment. They get raised up into the environment. The environment wears the rocks down due to superficial processes related to wind, water, and ice. The higher the rocks get pushed up, the more effect the environment can have. Here's a picture of a destructive geologic force called a waterfall. Here's another one called Railroad Creek. And here's a glacier. There are some things that are in this slideshow that aren't in your packet. If you feel those are crucial to your ongoing geologic education, let me know, and I will provide you this PowerPoint. This is the only, no, there are two pictures of this PowerPoint that aren't mine. This happens to be one of them, so we probably pull it out. You're free to use my stuff, you just can't get paid for it. We have five guiding principles or laws. The first one is called the principle of least astonishment. The second is called the principle of uniformitarianism. The third is the law of original horizontality. The fourth is the law of superposition. And the fifth is the law of cross-cutting relationships. If it's not already apparent, I sort of work through analogy. Try to explain something that has nothing to do with geology and then tie it into geology. I think of these as sort of the grammar rules. Rocks themselves are the words. We find a rock and it's interesting. And it may even be beautiful. And it's like a single word. What does it mean? No idea. These are the things that help us to put those words into context. Our primary guiding principle is expressed philosophically as Occam's razor. The principle that entities must not be multiplied beyond necessity. The popular interpretation of this principle is that the simplest explanation is usually the correct one. In geology, like we'll do tomorrow, we will come up with all sorts of hypotheses. How did this get this way? And I'll have an idea, and someone else will have an idea, and a third person will have an idea, and we'll write them all down, and we'll talk about them, and community will decide. Or one of us will be really strong-minded, and they'll buffalo everybody else into the idea that they think is best. But when we have a number of competing hypotheses, usually what happens is that the simplest explanation is the best. Philosophically, that's called Occam's razor. I only heard this maybe 10 years ago working with some folks who came out of the University of Arizona, which they called the principle of least astonishment. Let's put together a scenario by which we won't be astonished. Right? If you have to come up with something really harebrained, it's probably not true. The question is, how did young Matthew Collins get all that spaghetti everywhere? We can come up with a number of hypotheses. One of them is that he's fairly young and not very dexterous, and he was eating and happened to lose some of his spaghetti. My theory is, however, that someone came along and stole a lot of his spaghetti and then put some on him to cover up the crime. The prime suspects would be his mother and father. His younger brother, Daniel, when questioned, he seemed not very certain of himself. We could posit his uncle, because his uncle had planned very early on to be nice to Matthew so that later he could steal his spaghetti. In fact, he turned him on to some cool tunes to further gain his trust. We might even think that some strangers were involved. They seem friendly on the outside. There's one person in that group who's an admitted thief, come to think of it. The simplest explanation is that young Matthew was very young at the time and was doing the best he could, and he got spaghetti everywhere. We could hypothesize that the cat snuggled under the 6 rolls of toilet paper and was so fatigued by it that it fell asleep. The principle of least astonishment would probably lead us to the idea that the cat fell asleep and then someone piled the toilet paper. That's the least astonishing to me. Oh, I'm sorry, this is off the internet as well. I don't own cats, I'm allergic to them. I'm not thinking that this is particularly nice to cats, but the cat doesn't seem to be minding. So. The last example of this I have, some of you will have seen this picture last night. This is me with a group of my highly paid and trained colleagues acting like goofuses. The thing to focus on this picture is the slow children playing sign. This is in probably the spring of 1998. If you go see that sign right now, there's been some alteration made. The slow child now has a Chicago Cubs baseball cap. We can hypothesize that somehow a random piece of magazine cover just in the shape of a Chicago Cubs baseball cap happened to come loose and somehow get a piece of tape affixed to it, blow in over the mountains, and stick to the sign. We could also think that perhaps someone who was a lifelong Cubs fan, who was given a magazine subscription, lifelong Cubs fan, was given a magazine subscription for his 50th birthday a few years ago, happened to see the cover, and was laying on the couch one day just before Christmas, decided that one of the pictures he'd seen, the cat might fit on Santa. And so this was the Santa on the Christmas tree that year. And then I decided, wait a minute, then someone decided that not enough people would see it there, so now it was placed on the sign. That's, although it's an absurd story, it's still the least astonishing. So, when we have a number of hypotheses, let's go with the one that causes us to go, are you kidding? All right, principle of least astonishment. The second, the principle of uniformitarianism. The present is the key to the past. Let's take a non-geologic example first. Let's say somehow we came across a field book that had some notes in it. The date up there is June 20th, 1997. Apparently that was a Friday because that's what it says up there. And this is a bunch of well data from the Holden mine site. And we happen to come across this here in the attic upstairs with a bunch of dust on it. And we look at it and we go, man, I wonder who it was that wrote that stuff down. And Chuck would ask Steph, and Steph would ask Chuck, and they'd have a community meeting about it, and nobody would know. One way that they might go about solving that is to send out, for all the people who had ever worked on the project, another log book to see. And here's one. Up at the top it says 5/24/10, 3 months ago. And down at the bottom it has a signature, D.M. Coberly. Hmm. And then they could compare the two. And go, yeah, I think that looks like it's his printing. So the present, 5/24/10, is the key to the past because of the similarity. And in fact, if we look at that page, the real page, I did sign down at the bottom because I'm supposed to do that all the time. No, I actually signed on both sides, right? For those people who are listening on DVD at home and can't see this slide, it's signed on both sides, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Your lava lamp, or do you want to?
Let's give it a little while longer.
And we can't see it over your computer, so we're going to have to hold it up.
Okay, I'll do that if you're not. We see rocks out in the field all the time, and we wonder how they got formed. In this case, we can find a picture that was witnessed of someone, and this formation that we see down here called Ropi or Pahoahoa lava, we see as being similar once that cools off even further to look just like that stuff is on that previous picture. We say the rules, the gravity has worked the same for the entire life of the planet. We make the assumption that volcanoes for the last while have blown up about the same way that they always have. And so we see this stuff now. So if we find it someplace else, we make the assumption, it's the principle of least astonishment, that this is the same process that gives us gives us that stuff. Another geologic example that I would use, sort of in the converse, we could go out right now and go look at Railroad Creek and go jump down in the creek and look at the rocks that are in there and see what size they are, and we'd scoop some out and we'd look and we'd find some sand underneath there and we'd get a picture in our head of what that is. And then we'd go away and do geology some other place and we'd come across a road cut and we would see material that looked exactly the same. Our conclusion would be, the principle of least astonishment, that it might have something to do with a stream, and it might have something to do with a stream kind of about the size of Railroad Creek. I will probably say this a few times. Does that make sense? Yes. One of the things that I have preached for the last 10 years is that geology is common sense. The only things about the physical world, the geologic world, that we don't know yet or that we can't figure out together is because I've done a crummy job of explaining it to you. There's particle physics that's dang complicated, and when somebody explains it to you, you go, that doesn't make any sense at all. Geology isn't that way. So geology makes sense. We can figure it out together. This is a picture taken right up across from the ball field, and we see these layers. Do you have a picture of this or not in your pack? We see these layers. If we breach a dam somewhere and let the river run free again, and it erodes through the old material and there's stuff left on the sides, we'll find stuff that looks exactly like this. And so every year, because we've been able to watch it in the dams, every year the spring flush comes in and brings a bunch of mud into the dam. And year after year after year after year after year, it piles up. In this case, our interpretation is there was a dam here 15,000 years ago, right across the valley, that was caused by a glacier. Material got plowed up at the front end of a glacier and dammed up the valley. And so for a long time, everything from here back, from the far end of that tall tailings pile is our best guess as to where this dam was. So everything from there back was a lake. And every spring, runoff would come in, bring in another thin layer of this material. What we see in the present day helps us figure out what used to be there. Or what we see in other places, we make an assumption it's the same mechanism. This is a picture of some rocks on the flank of Mount St. Helens, taken 6 or 7 years ago, after May 18th, 1980. My assessment is that this is material that was blown up and out of Mount St. Helens. It's angular, it's sharp, this stuff right here is probably kind of pumice-y stuff. So I have this picture with me, and I kind of have it in my head so that if I were traveling some other place and I came across some stuff like this, I would say, well, looks kind of Mount St. Helens-ish to me. I don't need to come up with my first explanation, my leading hypothesis will be, okay, let's go look for the volcano. Or let's go look in the geologic literature and find out if in this part of Mexico there was a volcano, or in this part of Greece, or something like that. I don't need to come up with a new hypothesis. That's the one that makes the most sense. Here's some more material from Mount St. Helens as well. In this case, this stuff is either ash or mud, very fine-grained stuff. This was probably some sort of mud flow that has these big things sort of stuck in it, and it came blobbing down the hill. That's a technical term, by the way, blobbing down the hill. And so, again, if I go someplace else and I see something that looked like this, I'll go, I think I have, what is that reminding me of? Okay, I'll try to get excited here in a little bit. I'll try to pick up the pace. Are there any questions? Yes, please. Oh, hey, who's over there hogging licorice?
Observation.
Oh! Observation, conclusion. Principle of, now, who had 9 pieces of licorice? I want to see who's got the red lips over here, because they're in trouble.
I didn't have any.
Good. All right.
Good turnout, Don.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry about that. Next, are you going to be here for a little while? Are you going to be around for?
Probably. 4 days.
Like
4
days.
All right, next session, I'm bringing red licorice again, and we're starting with you. All right?
Yes.
All right. Any questions about
geology?
Okay. We've covered the principle of least astonishment, the principle of uniformitarianism, the law of original horizontality. Most rocks are sedimentary. They're made of sediment that falls and becomes turned into rock. Most sedimentary rocks are formed of small fragments falling under the force of gravity. Gravity works downward, it always has. Sedimentary rocks are laid down flat or nearly so. The conclusion we come to is tilted rocks were not laid down in a tilted fashion, because that would be astonishing. So the question, all of the law of original horizontality is pretty not real very interesting until you get to the end, which is when we find rocks that aren't flat, that's probably not how they got laid down. We have to come up with a reason as to how they got not flat. This is a set of rocks, my professional opinion. How many other geologists do we have in the room right now? People licensed in 2 states? We do. Yeah, okay. My interpretation of this is that these, in fact, were lake sediments, very similar to the ones that we see up the valley here. They were laid down flat. They're not flat now. I didn't tilt the camera. This is a road cut near Banff, Canada. You could drive by and take this same picture. So in our, as we go about doing geology, we have our story somewhere has to say the rocks got tilted up. They didn't get laid down like this. Is there anybody, I gotta get out of light for a second. Does anybody really, 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 really think they got laid down tilted like that? Because I'll entertain that hypothesis. But that's more astonishing to me than them being laid down flat and then being tilted up. We got through that one quickly. The law of superposition. The oldest stuff is on the bottom. If you go to my house on Sunday, that's the day I do laundry. My housemate does laundry on Saturday, I do mine on Sunday. So this is a standard Sunday. Somewhere in the early afternoon, I go in and I go to my laundry basket and I look in my laundry basket and there's enough stuff in there to do a load. So I take out all of my clothes and here they are. What the principle of superposition says is probably this red and white striped golf shirt is on the bottom of the stack and it would therefore be oldest. And then I think the next thing in the stack is this green and blue striped golf shirt. There's a couple of socks sticking out up there. This is a pair of tan pants. On top of the tan pants is another red and white striped golf shirt, a light blue golf shirt on top of that, some more socks, and then a pair of gray pants on top, which we saw in the previous photo. So, the principle of least astonishment would say that, now one thing, I could have thrown all of this stuff on the floor like I used to when I was a high schooler and then collected it all up, so it wouldn't really be true. These days I'm trained enough that at the end of the, when I'm done with a shirt, I throw it in the hamper. So this is my interpretation, and I'm thinking yours also should be, that this is the shirt that I wore the longest ago, and then this one next, and maybe I wore those pants for 2 days, that's what I do sometimes. And then after that I changed to the gray pants, but in those intervening times I wore the red shirt and the blue shirt. Does that make sense? Anybody see that as being unreasonable? There's a corollary to this. All we can talk about here is the relative older or younger. This was the first shirt I wore. This was the second shirt I wore. The red one, that's the third shirt I wore. Third one, fourth one. This could be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. This could be April. May, June, and July, right? There's no, custom maybe would say that maybe one a day. This could be 2008, right? There's no concrete age associated with any of this, just relative, older to younger. Taking it into the geologic context, we would assume that these beds that are laid down here, again, these are all sedimentary rocks. My belief is they're sedimentary. They were laid down probably again in a lake because they're so flat, and that they were laid down so that these are probably the oldest, and those at the top are probably the youngest. Another set of sedimentary rocks, I'll make the same assessment there. Now there's a question that comes up. How are we on time here, by the way? How long do I have?
Till 7:15.
Till 7:15. All right. Excellent. Give that a little wild cook. Yeah. A question. Are we seeing things right? That's always a question we might ask ourselves, and not just in geology class. We need to ask ourselves which way is up. In the geologic world, where we have this set of beds that have been tipped up on end, there are in fact two hypotheses that we should entertain. And one is that the beds were laid down oldest to youngest, right? Everybody with me so far? And tipped up like this, so that these would be the oldest. Younger, 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 as you go that, right? There's another hypothesis, right? There's another. We have to entertain anything that's plausible, anything that's possible, reject the crazy stuff, and then whatever we're left, right? Sherlock Holmes, noted geologist. When you get rid of everything that's impossible, whatever's left, however implausible, is probably what happened. The other thing that's possible is that the rocks got laid down flat with oldest down here, youngest up here, tilted, and now this is where we see them. So that in this case, oldest is up here and we get younger as we go that way. Is there anyone who thinks that's impossible? This is called overturning. To go from where we are to the closest overturned beds is right there, because the Holden ore body that we find oriented in space about like this didn't get raised up like this. It got raised up like this and came all the way open. So this is a fairly common occurrence. in geology, so it's one that we need to entertain. The possibility exists that when I was pulling my laundry out, rather than pulling it out with my hand underneath the bottom and the one on top and bringing it up so that my friend could take the photo, what I really did was went, good grief, my nose really itches, and switched my hands around and switched the whole stack around, right? That possibility exists. We covered that. I covered that sneakily at the start by showing you this picture that shows the gray pants were at the top. And so when you see them in my hands, the gray pants are still at the top. Is there some other laundry in there that you want to know about?
That solid red shirt.
That's unusual since most
of
those shirts
golfer?
Are striped.
It's an anomaly in the laundry.
Now that possibility exists, or else that could be the collar of the shirt, because I still see some of the lines here, and I see some, you may be onto something.
Well, let's explore those possibilities.
Sorry?
Let's explore those possibilities.
Let's do that. Let's do that over a cup of coffee. In the room? Yes, please, go ahead.
Should we be concerned that we don't see any underwear in your hair?
Cliff, can I ask you a question?
No.
Should Elizabeth be concerned that she doesn't see any underwear in my hamper?
She should be worried.
From the medical perspective, is the daily use of underwear really necessary? If there weren't small children here, this would go a completely different direction. And so thank you for being here, because no good would have come from it. All right. Back in 1997, when we first came here to work, my field gear was tan pants and a gray t-shirt. And one day I was coming out of the laundry right there, and I think he was the operations manager, and I had my stack of laundry with me, which was about 6 pairs of tan pants and about 15 gray t-shirts. And I was walking, and he said, oh, hey, how's it going? I said, fine, I just got done laundry. And he looked down at the stack, and he said, you know, I'm kind of glad to see that. And I'm like, what are you talking? And he said, well, you know, we see you in tan pants and gray shirt every day. We weren't sure how many you had. That's a true story.
Yeah, see, no underwear there.
He's consuming less resources.
What's the conclusion? Do you see any lines? Am I going to be in a car accident up here? Enough said. All right. In the real geologic world, we have ways of helping figure out which way is up. Curved surfaces usually bow downwards rather than upwards, and graded bedding, which means from big particles to small, from large to small, when the bed is right side up. So when we see surfaces like this, this would be a concave surface. This is concave down rather than concave up. When you make humps in the world wants to erode the humps away, right? When we put a mountain up, when geologic forces put a mountain up, what the mountain's trying to do is erode it away. The other hypothesis that we have here is that this is all overturned, and therefore here's this little hump in the world that streams let go and be there, and that's not the way it works. This is probably a stream channel. This curve shape is curved down. This is probably right side up. This is down in Florida. This is a coral reef here that, again, my thinking is that there was a stream that had come this way that eroded this curved downward surface into it and then filled in with sediment. And so, again, my take would be that this is right, everything is right side up rather than upside down. Again, the other thing the other hypothesis we would entertain would be to flip the whole thing over If we went and found that this was a termite mound, now maybe it makes some more sense. Right? That there are places where there are termite mounds. That we could go and we could check this, and my thinking would be if we'd walk over there and we'd find out that it was really fine sediment, and we'd say that came from the stream, and therefore everything makes sense. The curve is down, the package is right side up. Yes?
Well, the lava lamp is...
the center of the earth. Hot, and I can attest to that. So I'm not going to do this for very long. This is the edges of the earth. Cool, very cool. Very cool. Blobs of material get heated by the heat source in the center of the earth. In this case, it's radioactive decay. Come to the surface, cool as they come to the surface. And then because when they... is that back in... I can probably just work off the screen for a little while here. Cool as they come to the surface. Cooler material gets denser. True. Keep material hot. The molecules are vibrating more. They elbow each other out of the way. They expand. It's less dense than the material surrounding it. It comes up. It cools. The molecules get closer together. They densify. I don't know if that's a term, but we'll go with it. The weight becomes the same, and it falls back down. It gets reheated, and the cycle happens again. Take this, and rather than having these be blobs, have them be cells. If we could make one of these that was really skinny, we would find these cells that would generate, and that's the mechanism, that's the force that drives the plates. Okay? Make sense? Oh, now I'm going to need to put this up a little bit. I'm going to punch the button. In this case, graded bedding, coarser material, bigger pieces down at the bottom, get finer as you go up. What happens when a stream floods? Most of the energy comes with the big pulse of the flood. Fast-moving water can move bigger fragments. Then after the flood passes, the water recedes, or when a flood hits Railroad Creek, there's a time when there's a whole bunch of water coming down, and then after that, the flow recedes gently, and so the stream carries small, it is not able to carry the big material, but can still carry the smaller material. As the stream flow decreases, you deposit finer and finer and finer material. That's what's going on here. If we try to flip this over and talk ourselves into now, what's a situation where a stream, unless it's maybe the Mississippi River, but a mountain stream like this or a small stream doesn't ramp up really slowly, right? A big thunderstorm hits up the valley here, and the stream flow, if we do a graph of the stream flow, the amount of water flowing down the stream, it's raining up the valley and not too much bad happens, and then pandemonium hits, and it goes way up, and then because the storm has ended, it takes a while for all the precipitation to come down all the little side valleys, and this thing trails off slowly. You don't see the opposite of that, which would be this slow buildup and then a quick drop off, which is what we would need if this package was turned upside down. Everybody buying that? It's true, and it's not true just because I'm saying it. The law of cross-cutting, we're almost through with all these stinking laws. The law of cross-cutting relationships. An igneous rock fault or other geologic feature must be younger than any rock across which it cuts. This is from the Oxford Dictionary, so you know it's true. They're English. That's kind of the imagery. Here's my non-geologic version of this. I used to do a different version, but this is the one I'm using now. This is along the Columbia River. We did some geotechnical work for the folks who were going to try to put in the LNG terminal there that has been since shot down. Let's try to figure out this. Those are deer tracks. I know that because I saw it happen. This, I think, is a four-wheeler that drilled on the sand at some point. And then, or maybe this was a tractor, I forget which, and this is a, then maybe this is the four-wheeler, but this might be a backhoe. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves is which thing happened first? And my interpretation is this thing was the first thing that came, because right in here we see how these tracks have cut across, not just in space, but lay on top of, because they've obliterated. We have these little divots here where the cleats moved, and then we get to this place, and they get washed away because. Say again.
First was that other tracks.
First was these up here.
Yeah, weren't they? Because then this thing went over the top of it.
Right. So this is the first batch. This is the second batch. This is the third batch, and this is the fourth batch because I was there when it happened. Everybody with me? That's the law of cross-cutting relationships. We take that into the geologic world. This is this may be that same road cut or someplace nearby in Banff. And here we have a bed that we can trace fairly easily. Hang on a second. What happened? It comes to right here and then stops, right? Here's another little layer that we can see. Oh, that one seems to continue through. What I see is a fault or a fracture that kind of runs through there. Here's one. This one is the big one that gets stopped. Here's one. This bed gets stopped. Our assessment is that this thing happened after the beds were laid down. Everybody with me? Anybody disagree? Does it make sense? We now use our geologic principles combined with our observation skills and common sense to go do geology. We have some rules. They're simple. We go out. We try to figure out what's going on. Here's a bunch of, this is a slide from yesterday, right? We have a bunch of layers of rock that have been laid down. We're going to make the guess that they were originally laid down horizontally. We have to come up with some reason why they got tipped up on end. They somehow got eroded off. And a new layer of material came in on top. This layer has to be the youngest. So we can put together a series of events. We have no idea where they fall on geologic time. 4 billion years ago yesterday, or 250 million years ago and 100 million years ago, there's nothing that I can tell that says these things happened at a certain time. We can just put them in their order. There are three types of rocks. We've covered all the rules of grammar. Now we're going to talk about words for just a second. There are three kinds. There are two kinds of trees, right? Leafy trees and needly trees. That's technical, I know. Deciduous and coniferous. Fine. There are three types of rocks. Igneous rocks, which were solidified from molten material. Metamorphic rocks, what does metamorphism mean? A butterfly metamorphoses? No. The whole thing goes. Yes, sir?
It changes.
It changes. That's exactly right. In this case, it changes by temperature or pressure. And then sedimentary rocks. Rocks made out of sediment, composed of particle, transported by a fluid, air, water, or water as ice. We're going to talk about these incredibly quickly. The way we name these rocks isn't important to us right now. I would hope if you're going to go on and study geology, you'll learn all this stuff. It's not the way. There's sandstone, there's siltstone, there's claystone. We don't need to know that right now. When we talk about sedimentary rocks, the first thing we're going to do is observe stuff. When we go out on our field trip, we're going to observe stuff. The first thing we look at is, or the things to look for, we can look for whatever we want to. The things that I would direct you to look at when you find sediment or sedimentary rocks. Are the rocks rounded or are they angular? Are they sharp? Is there one particle type or many particle types? Is there one particle size or are there many particle size? This is a picture of sandstone. That's the other thing that I stole off the internet. Here are two jars of material. A picture of two jars of material. Here are the actual jars of material. We can do a quick compare and contrast to say, lots of different kinds of rock or one kind of rock?
One kind.
Lots of different sizes or one kind of size?
One.
Rounded or angular? Hard to say. Rounded would be like marbles. Angular would be like sharp fragments. Another jar of material. One kind of rock or many kind of rocks?
Many
kind of rocks. One size or many sizes?
Many.
And what's the other one? Rounded or angular?
Both.
What that means right now, this is where we would go into the interpretation mode. We've made the observation. I agree with everything that you said. In fact, this is a jar of material that I drilled up in Nebraska back a couple of months ago. And one of the last continental glacier came down to nearby, and this material was deposited fairly close. But the environment is a big rock tumbler. When stuff spends a long time in the rock tumbler, it all gets to be the same size. It all gets to be rounded. This stuff is quartz, which is the toughest stuff out there. Some of this stuff isn't quartz, so it gets banged up and either physically broken apart or chemically altered, so it's gone. This stuff is fairly new and close to where it was deposited. This stuff is actually from the mountain front in Wyoming. This is a commercial material that gets mined up there, and we use it when we install groundwater wells. And that stuff laid on a beach and got pounded by the beach for a couple hundred million years. Getting pounded on for a couple hundred million years will take all the weak out, right? This is what gets left. Makes it all the same size. In this case, if there's small stuff in there, it kind of hides in between the big particles as they tumble across each other. Once everything gets to be about the same size, there's no place to hide. So now everything is breaking into other stuff the same size. Anything crazy about what I just said? Here's a soil or a mud flow of some kind. This is in Indonesia. Again, there are particles that have been transported. In this case, the fluid was mud. For now, we should think about what the rocks have to tell us rather than what to call them. We've talked about sedimentary rocks. 70% of the rocks that we can see on the surface of the planet are sedimentary rocks. We happen to be in a little funky corner of the world here where there aren't a lot of sedimentary rocks. What we will see tomorrow on the hike and what you will see hiking around are the other two kinds of rocks, metamorphic and igneous. Metamorphic rocks, rocks that have been changed. The thing to think about is what's the degree of change? And this is something that probably isn't really intuitive to you in the moment, so tomorrow we'll talk about it and I'll tell you my opinion of it. And next time you're here with another geologist, they'll tell you their opinion and you can compare and contrast. Are the rocks folded in a certain direction and how much? That's one question to ask ourselves. And is the rock banded? As a rock stays under pressure longer, not only does it get folded, the grains themselves, the chemistry differentiates so that the rock becomes banded. When we see a banded rock like that, that's a higher level. It either means more temperature or more pressure. Those are the things that can vary at the Earth's surface. This is a piece of metamorphic rock. Metamorphosed means changed. This is somewhere here in the village. I was out walking around today and took this picture. This thing originally was lake sediments that sat under pressure. If you put lake sediments under pressure and it's all just vertical pressure, you get slate. And you make pool tabletops out of it because it's flat as can be. The fact that we see some waviness here means that the pressure wasn't just down, but there was some pressure from one of the other sides. And if we find this thing in place, we can measure what that direction is. If you push on something this way, the fold folds either up or down, looking out at you guys, right? If you push on something this way, the fold goes perpendicular to it. So we would measure the fold, we would measure these, if we see curved surfaces and they repeat themselves, we could measure those with our compass, and then we would think backwards and say, all right, if that's the way the fold is, if the folds all run this way, then the pressure had to come kind of like that. Here's another piece of metamorphic rock. In fact, one we're going to see tomorrow on the hike. We're salting your, I'm trying to get you prepped up for tomorrow so that tomorrow's easy. That's metamorphic rocks. Igneous rocks, the last kind we have to look at. When we look at igneous rocks, the first thing we think about is crystal size. An igneous rock has cooled from the molten state. Things can cool one of two ways, slowly or quickly. If something cools very quickly, it cools so quickly that the crystals can't form. So if we find something that has small crystals in it, our assessment would be that that cooled very quickly. Hawaiian lava that was underground yesterday got pooped out today and got cooled after about 45 minutes. Those crystals have no chance to grow. If you pick up a piece of Hawaiian lava, it's either glassy or the crystals are very small. Yosemite granites cooled very slowly and very deep and have since been raised up to the surface so that now we can see them and people can climb them. And so when you find a Yosemite granite, the crystals are very big. You can see them even without a magnifying glass. The last thing that we would look at is, can we figure out what kind of crystals there are? There's a whole portion of geology called mineralogy, because the way the chemistry fits, minerals form in different shapes, right? People have seen enough geology to know that there are halite, salt, rock salt forms little cubes. Other stuff forms that's a reflection of the underlying chemistry. So we would look at predominantly the crystal shape and also the color that would lead us into what we think the chemistry of the original pot of stuff was that this stuff cooled on. Here's a rock in the village. This is an igneous rock that's cooled. We can say the crystals are of a certain size. They're neither real big nor real small. So our guess is that this thing cooled intermediately and maybe at an intermediate depth. If you want to get all technical, here's the full rock description. If you want to do it my way and not worry about what a rock's called and just see what it can tell us, then that's fine. If you want to get all technical, we can do that. That's a biotite hornblende quartz diorite. It's gray to dark gray, medium green, xenomorphic to hypidiomorphic. The andesine crystals are subparallel locally. The biotite and hornblende are anhedral. Quartz and orthoclase are interstitial. It's mostly massive, of course, and you guys will see this all tomorrow and it'll make perfect sense to you. But it's gnisic along the west margin. Mafic streaks and lenses are common locally. The contact is sharp degradation. You wonder why I changed into studying groundwater? I assume that if next time I break a bone, and somebody sends some stuff to Cliff so he can review it for me, it's going to be on this same level of jargon, because this all makes, I'm hoping in that world, that it makes sense to Cliff. Each of these things, the hornblende are anhedral. That means that the crystals don't have the classic form to them. They cooled quickly enough that they couldn't yet. Hornblende, one of the characteristics of hornblende is when you see a hornblende crystal, it has a sharp, it's like a 30 and 120 cross-section. In this case, it cooled so quickly that those things couldn't form. So this anhedral is a term that means the crystals aren't very well formed. Quartz and orthoclase are interstitial. That's the kind of the stuff in between the crystals that get formed. So all of this has some technical meaning to it, and I'm kind of making fun of it, but this is the kind of stuff that drove me out of geology right here. Here's two rocks. They're both igneous. Can we make a guess that perhaps if we would take some of this and grind it up and melt it down, that we would see a different chemistry from the two of them, because this one has more dark material in it That's reflective of the chemistry. This stuff is lighter. Seem reasonable? Anybody want to say no, these are going to be exactly the same? How to do a geology, right? How much time we got?
None.
Our mantra is you can observe a lot just by watching. Let's leave it right there. Tomorrow at 10:15, go get your coffee. Be down here at 10:20 or 10:25. Jim is going to talk a little bit about how to write on a hike. I'm going to not do anything. We're going to go do a geology hike that is also going to be a writing hike and an observing hike and a beauty seeing hike and all that other stuff I said at the start a while ago that I can't remember. Any questions, come see me some other time, except now it's time to go to bed. Thank you.